Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked. I'm Lehman Kessler, Mother Rachel Kessler. We are...
I'm being pulled along on this strange roller coaster of
that
a podcast.
That is correct. Yes, no, there's no time for preamble, Rachel. There's no time for blah, blah, blah. It's been 2 weeks, 3 weeks. We have literally just finished watching season 3 and subsequently all of television's Hannibal. Rachel, your thoughts?
Yes.
Yep, that's pretty much where I'm at.
Just so you all know, that is literally the level of preparation that goes into this podcast.
We are giving you our raw emotional state. There is no time to process. I literally plugged in the microphone, poured a bottle or a glass of blood red wine.
A bottle.
Well, it's what's remaining of our bottle.
Okay.
And we're just gonna jump into it. Did we do a season 2 recap?
I don't remember.
I think we talked probably just a bit about Hannibal for season 2, which was, you know, its own kind of madness. But we have just finished season 3. Good Lord. This goes without saying, but spoilers.
Will there be spoilers?
I think there's gonna be spoilers. But again, this is... technically something that's, you know, been out there for a while. Like, you know, Red Dragon has existed for, I think, since the 80s.
Although the final twist of the season, of the series, is not the ending of Red Dragon.
No. So, for those who have not been keeping up with Hannibal, watching Hannibal, then either you can listen and enjoy our sort of feverish ramblings, or go out and watch it, because... it's possibly the most amazing television.
Pretty awesome. Not gonna lie. It's pretty fantastic. Although the only person I've known who's been capable of binge-watching it was your mother when she was holding our newly born child.
But see, that's, I think, like, my mother read this stuff. Like,
yes,
like, I think she was into Thomas Harris. I mean, all she reads are murder books, right? I mean, I grew up on Murder, She Wrote, which is fairly, you know, mild. But I'm a child watching a show about murder.
Right.
The only television I was allowed to watch during school days was PBS's Mystery. So, yeah.
So anyway, do you want to talk season 3 in season 3 specifically and then go back and do our analysis of Hannibal?
I guess so. Yeah, cuz we did a lot of sort of our early analysis of Hannibal.
I feel like we've done at least one whole episode dedicated to Hannibal.
We definitely talked about it season 1. I don't know if I think we may have touched on parts of season 2,
right,
and what we liked of season 2. But season 3 has been this whole...
a journey.
This whole other beast. Like, this show started out as a kind of...
procedural and then some?
Yeah, like a kind of commentary on procedurals and...
No, I think that's really important. I think the first season, what it really accomplished was it was a commentary on the murder porn that is...
yes.
Right? While arguably contributing to it, but I would argue not.
Definitely subverting it.
I would say subverting it rather than contributing to it, because the way that, like, the violence was so grotesque in the first season, and it kind of played on that voyeuristic relationship we have to violence as a society.
Yeah.
And yet in challenging us to look at it was also making us see how grotesque it was.
Well, and season 2 really suddenly, like, because you had, like, you know, you essentially introduced this world of superhuman serial killers who can, you know...
well, superhuman serial killers who, like, through their, like, they're trying to create something through their blood and death and gruesomeness, like, because that's the whole thrust of that this is my design.
Yes.
And that's the whole point of Will, is that Will has this capacity in him to see the beauty and to see the statement that these killers are making.
he's the Admiral Thrawn of serial killers. Because Admiral Thrawn's whole thing was that he could, like, by...
I have not read that book since I was 12.
So, for those who are unaware of the Heir to the Empire series that I am now going to draw into our Hannibal episode, Admiral Thrawn was one of the coolest characters to come out of the expanded universe. But upon going back and rereading, very poorly written. As an idea, he's really cool.
Was anything in that book not poorly written? Because I have not read it since I was 12, and I only assume that everything in it was poorly written.
I reread it in my 20s, and man alive, is it a bad scene. But no, Admiral Thrawn, the whole point is that he's the only alien Grand Admiral in this super racist empire, and he is super brilliant, and the way that Zahn shows his brilliance is that he... learns about a culture by their art and thus understands their entire, like, mentality and their tactics they'll use and how to outwit them and how to outmaneuver them. But it's all based on understanding art. And it's this kind of cool, interesting sort of vibe. And in the same way, Will Graham can understand serial killers through their quote-unquote art. But
that's the blessing and the curse of Will, right? That's the whole crux of Will's relationship with Hannibal, is that Will can, like, this is someone Hannibal can... theoretically connect with, because Will can see what Hannibal sees.
Well, and
what does it mean for Will that he can see what these sociopaths can see?
Well, and the killers are about creating works in a weird way, right? Like, if I were Andrew Reeves, I would, like, launch into a sort of a strange thing about the Silmarillion and, like, Morgoth is unable to create, only pervert.
Hi, Andrew.
And I think there's something about that here, right? Like, all of these people are creating something, whether it is...
But it is a pervert. Well, I mean, that's the whole point about Hannibal, is that Hannibal is, especially in the first season, Hannibal is seen as, like, a Satan figure, and it's not that he creates evil, but he takes things that are good and twists them and distorts them, right? That's the subversion of beauty and food and community and fellowship and all, and even his friendship with Will, right?
Well, the fact that his relationships with people are him twisting them and crafting them into something else. But I'm thinking, like, Molly Shannon is trying to create a family. Naked Angel Dude is trying to create his weird Naked Angel things. Totem Pole Guy.
Right.
So,
Weird Cello Guy?
Weird Cello Guy. And then season two really, like, well, A, you've got the guy creating the mosaic, you know, like, that's his big thing of art. But it shrinks the world down, right? Because you're stuck in the asylum with Will and the court. Like, the world is suddenly that much smaller.
Yeah.
Because there's mosaic guy. And
it's not an episodic string of serial killer.
It's not the monster of the week that season one is.
The mosaic guy is, like, the first... For those of you who are not informed, Mosaic Guy refers to the serial killer who is making in a water tower a mosaic of dead bodies.
Yes, to create the image of an eye, or like an eye looking up.
Right. It was that arc that gave us Hannibal's murder suit.
It did give us the plastic murder suit.
But through which you could still see Hannibal's fine sartorial choices. But
the other serial killer was the guy killing all the law enforcement people and the judge.
That's right. Who was the guy Will eventually did kill? Will eventually kills him, doesn't he?
I don't know.
But that's the one that led to them faking Freddie Lowndes' death, because Will was supposed to have killed Freddie Lowndes, and
I
really forgot what happened in season two.
Season two, that's the guy who tries to kill Hannibal, like, who, like, crucifies Hannibal, or, like,
oh, I remember Hannibal. That. Yeah, the security guard. Yes, I know what you mean.
I think Hannibal just gets him back.
Yes.
And then there's the weird, like, Mechano Beast guy.
That's the one Will does
kill. So there's,
kill.
Like, three of them in that season, plus just Hannibal's general sort of murder.
So the crux of season two, introduces slightly more prolonged story arcs. And it also has the, you know, examination of Will, right? Like, it's almost like
Is Will being transformed by Hannibal?
Is Will being transformed by Hannibal and answering that? So the first half of the season is exploring that question. And the final arc of the season is Will's commitment to catching Hannibal.
Yeah.
And the that question becomes answered.
Yeah.
Will refuses to be transformed by Hannibal, and the crux of the end arc is how to catch him.
Yes.
Framed by that great the fist fight between Jack Crawford and Hannibal.
Yes. Oh, like, yeah.
Bookends the season, which is fantastic. Because the whole second season, you know that's what it's going to lead to.
And then season... Which
is a really satisfying moment, I have to say.
Oh, and there's all the Verger stuff.
And all the...
That was the Verger stuff, thing. Right. So those are sort of like the four kind of beats that were hit. Bringing down Dr. Chilton and making Dr. Chilton like everyone think that he was the Ripper.
Yeah. But the... And I guess the Mason Verger stuff is significant because that starts introducing more of the actual characters in the canon from Thomas Harris's novels.
Yeah. And this season three really has two sections. I guess sort of like...
Really two mini seasons.
Yeah, two mini seasons with like a kind of little episode in between.
Yeah.
To sort of wrap up the Verger stuff.
But there is there's literally a 3-year break.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, yeah, we're just going to jump into that because otherwise our heads will explode. So the first half of this season was this bizarre... Montreal through a yellow filter. Hannibal in Italy. Hannibal in Italy and Will Graham kind of bouncing around Europe on his heels in this bizarre, like, I want to catch him, but I don't, but I do.
Yeah.
Just this, you know...
Ambivalence, deep ambivalence,
which takes him to Hannibal's, you know, home.
Yeah.
Where's he from?
Lithuania,
I think so. Yeah. And meeting his bizarre childhood friend, the Japanese assassin.
Yeah.
Which is very strange. I feel like there's a lot of this, which is them sort of stuck with Richard Harris's bizarre biography of Hannibal with
it's weird because
polydactylism.
And this is where I feel conflicted because I struggled with the first half of this season.
Well, it's...
I mean, it was... It's unlike anything else that's on television in that it is shot like a weird indie art film. And we forgot to even talk about like the running visual theme in the second season where
the Wendigo.
Yeah. Like there's this like Wendigo image superimposed that represents Hannibal.
But also, and like the elk that represents, I guess, what Will Graham's like.
I think the elk represents Will's like, or... like the hunt in Will, right? But it's not even that Will's murderous tendencies, but that Will can see what these serial killers are seeing. Well, what that's calling out in him.
I guess the central question of the show, and I'll present this now and we can come back to it.
Okay.
Is Will being transformed by Hannibal? Is Hannibal being transformed by Will?
Yeah.
Right? Like that's at the crux of this, right? Because Hannibal is trying to make his friend, make his almost like an apprentice, but like,
yeah,
you know, is trying to.
But do you see Hannibal change? Is there any change in Hannibal?
Well, that I don't know that because I don't think so.
No,
I mean, it's a, you know, by the end of the season, it's hard to tell what's going on, and there's a few hiccups along the way that really I want to get into.
So let's get into your hiccups.
So we have this sort of the giallo, like Dario Argento sort of Italian horror with strange kind of pseudo-sexual elements, which...
Oh, yeah, let's not forget that Scully is also running around Italy with Hannibal.
Yes, oh, yes, that's very important. Scully and Hannibal are sort of murdering their way through the Italian academy.
Well, she's not she takes a while to start murdering with
him. She's just sort of there. Yes. She's at the dinner courses, as it were.
Yes.
So Hannibal is murdering his way into places of prominence so that he can lecture on Dante... And that's that's the other thing for these like two halves is these, you essentially have the Dante part of the season and the Blake part of the season.
Yeah, yeah.
This is all about like woodcuts and what era is Blake? He's not Renaissance.
No, he's the Victorian, I think.
Oh, well, is that late
or Romantic?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, he's much later.
For some reason, I thought he was like 18th century or something.
Maybe I feel like he's a Romantic.
Well, regardless, those are sort of the two central artists that are being evoked throughout these seasons.
Okay, so let's focus on the first half of the season. Because this is my struggle, is that I did really struggle with a lot of the episodes in the first... I mean, there was some really good stuff, but it was just so, like, metaphorical ponderings and so, like... There was just like, I was like, give me some like linear narrative that I can,
well, and it's
that I can hold on to. And I feel like if they had just waited until the second half of the season to make a decision about whether to cancel Hannibal or not.
Oh, I see.
It just, because I feel like there is an argument to be made for the second half of the season being stronger than the first.
Well, it's certainly a more ordered.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because the second half is just the plot of the Red Dragon with additional crazy Hannibal stuff going on. But really, it's the, and you sort of looked up the
summation? I read the summary of Red Dragon on Wikipedia.
So,
and it does a very fascinating job of hitting the, I mean, as far as I can tell from the Wikipedia summary, my apologies to any Thomas Harris fans out there. But it seems to do a good job of hitting the major plot points. Like, as far as I can tell from a Wikipedia summary, those same elements appeared in the story.
The skeleton
of
the
story. But putting it in the context of this different.
Well, and they don't have that with this. With this, instead, they're sort of fleshing out Hannibal's biography.
Yeah.
They're giving you this bizarre, like, kind of look at Will and Will's quest for Hannibal, and almost like this sort of quest for Hannibal's soul in a weird way.
Yeah.
And then you're also getting flashbacks to Eddie Izzard.
There was a lot of Eddie Izzard and a lot of snails. Snails and what was the other thing that he fed Eddie Izzard to make him taste better?
Was it some sort of nut?
Snails and nuts? I don't know.
Almonds? Anyway, there were
a lot of flashbacks to Eddie Izzard. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I feel like I slept through a bunch of those episodes.
Well, it's this bizarre, like, European, I think it's trying to evoke this giallo horror, which I only personally been introduced to relatively recently, but that's all about this kind of pseudo-erotic, yet, you know, still very violent and creepy, and the pacing is all sort of, like, psychedelic, and you don't...
Well, I feel like this season they were really rendering... I feel like this kind of quasi-homoerotic relationship between Will and Hannibal has been simmering under the surface, or has been, like... Has been played with and evoked, but I feel like it became... It went from being subtext to text this season.
Although, I expected it to go full-on explicit, and it didn't.
And it didn't. It did not.
There was a couple of moments where I thought, okay, are they just going to, you know, fan service, quote-unquote, this out?
Yeah.
And they never quite went there.
No, but they came, became much more, not overt sounds bad, I don't mean, like, but it just became a much more consciously referenced thing, I feel like, this season, or much more...
Well, they talked about love, right? Like, love was brought up.
This is more of a, like, actually playing into the romantic feelings between the two of them.
Well, and the fact that you could sort of compare Scully's relationship, and we should probably not call her Scully.
Okay.
Scully
is Bedelia?
Bedelia. Okay, let's go back to Scully. The fact that you have sort of Scully and Will having this, you know, kind of talking like two mistresses, or two exes kind of comparing notes, right? Like, there is this... And again, and
there was this weird possessiveness between the two of them, and it was fascinating, really.
But the strangeness of the, like, weird guy that's being kept on the Lecter estates and being kept alive by snails because Hannibal framed him for the murder and eating of his sister, when really Hannibal killed his sister.
Yeah.
It was very, very strange. The bizarre kind of loyalty of
But that's like the Thomas Harris canon that had to get...
That had to get sort of, wedged in.
Because from what I understand in my limited knowledge of Thomas Harris is that no one really likes the Hannibal novel.
I think I've heard that as well.
Right? That he wrote Red Dragon and he wrote Silence of the Lambs. And then kind of got pressured into going back and filling in Hannibal's backstory.
Yeah, I think you are.
So Brian Fuller is kind of stuck with this canon.
He does sort of play loose and free with the canon as well, right? Or deals with the reality that he can't use Clarice Darling because that's owned by Hallmark or something ridiculous like that. They bought the rights to any stories involving Clarice Darling in the Hannibal universe. Like, the rest of the Hannibal stuff was free, but they couldn't use Clarice Darling because in case they want to make, like, The Adventures of Clarice Darling.
Wow.
So I think that's what the weird, sort of side story with My Girl was about. In the same way that I heard a fun theory that...
Setting up Miriam Last to... If Hannibal hadn't gotten taken away from us, setting up Miriam Last to be the
Clarice Starling character.
Or at least to be, like, or at least that was a way of referencing it, okay. like having this, like, you know, genius, brilliant, you know, FBI profiler who is, you know, kind of manipulated by Jack Crawford. Yeah. And then, yeah, and then sort of further manipulated and by Hannibal. I really also like a theory put out that Eddie Izzard is essentially a parody of the Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
Hannibal.
Yeah,
yeah, like, he is doing
everyone
that
thinks
shtick.
That he is. Well, yeah. And they play into that with this is the Chesapeake Ripper, yeah. but not the Chesapeake Ripper and all of that. Yeah. yeah no, I
with the sort of a snarky totally relationship with Chilton and things like that. And oh, my Lord, what the things they've done to.
That guy cannot die!
The Rasputin of this show. Anyway, that's getting ahead of ourselves. So I think the major beats to hit are, in the first part of the season, are, you know, weird backstory of Hannibal. Lots and lots of sort of pseudo Italy, you know, running the and then the bizarre like bounty that Mason Verger,
yeah.
who now that he's had his face eaten is played by a different actor, which I thought was kind of awesome. Mason Verger's put this bounty out on Hannibal and is trying to, you know, get his grips on him before the FBI can, or, you know, in conjunction with the FBI. Which also begins this sort of bizarre, like, erotic relationship between Carolyn Devernass and his sister.
Yes.
Which was strange, and which I'm like, is that sort of exploitative? Is that, like, just cheesecake? But it's not, because it's not pleasant in any way,
right? Well,
it's
not pleasant in any way. The character in the novel is literally, is specifically a lesbian.
Yes. Although, isn't Carolyn Davernes's character a dude?
Well, that I wonder if that... I don't know enough about the canon to... I can't imagine that...
Yeah.
I know that Alan Bloom in the novels, I don't know that person would have had any relationship with Margot Verger, but I'm just saying the character That's in the true. Novels is... Although, apparently there was some sketchy stuff. That makes me sad. I'm like, why can't there be any...
Anything nice?
Why can't there be any, like... creative person in Hollywood that doesn't do something stupid on Twitter.
Oh, yeah,
but
yeah.
apparently there was, like, a Twitter thing between Brian Fuller and some members of the lesbian community who were upset in the second season that Margot Verger would have had sex because she slept with Will Grant.
Oh, right.
In the second season because she was desperate to have a baby.
Right.
And I think you, despite the fact that the character is in the canon a lesbian, yeah. I think you can make an argument that given how much she wanted to have a child, she would have still slept with Will.
Well, I guess the question of whether they had any kind of relationship.
Well, they didn't, right? They didn't. She literally just said that she wanted to sleep with him to have a baby, right?
Or was manipulated into by Hannibal and blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah,
blah,
blah,
blah, blah.
Exactly. But then, like, I think you could make that work, but then apparently Brian Fuller said some obnoxious things about, like, Will converting someone from that. Like, okay. You're like, and it was just, I don't remember exactly what it was. I just know he said something vaguely insensitive and got people riled up. And I just wanted to be like, no, Brian Fuller, you're supposed to be one of the good ones.
Yeah.
And you're gay yourself. But
gay, but did inform one of my filmmaker friends that he could not help himself but stare at her cleavage at some, like,
yes,
a film to do, which I thought was kind of hilarious.
Anywho, so that was, I don't feel like I have a lot to say on the first half of the season.
Okay, well, I want to touch on the fact that we get the amazing comeuppance fight between Jack and Hannibal.
Yeah,
it's like awesome. Where
that
Hannibal,
that was pretty darn awesome.
Where Hannibal is trying to pull his standard, like, you know, oh, your wife is dead, you know, did she blah, 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 and Jack Crawford is just...
Having none of it.
Is just, like, going to town. Although, still flinging him over the window so that he can escape, which I'm like, that's dumb. Yeah. But anyway, I guess the show has to continue. They can't just capture him there. But that then leads to my first real, real hiccup of the show, which is, did Hannibal really intend to eat Will's brains? Not a lot of shows where this is a question that has to be raised. But at one point, towards the end of the arc in Italy, Hannibal has both Jack Crawford and Will captured and is going to eat Will's brains. Like, it's literally, like, about to cut into his skull. Does cut, like begins to, like, you know, saw his way through his head, and then Verger's goons show up and capture
because
him.
Because it doesn't fit the MO for who Hannibal wants to eat.
I guess, and so I'm trying to figure out, like, is this part of a larger game? Was he, because I think he was genuinely surprised to be captured by, like, as much as Hannibal is a master planner, I don't think he can plan that. So is this just an act of desperation? Like, he feels this is the last time he's going to see Will?
I think you can make an argument that Will had, because there was that moment in the church when Will was, like, declared himself done with Hannibal or something like that.
And yeah.
Maybe Hannibal felt that he had completely failed in
Project
his efforts,
Will.
Project
okay.
Will, and that if he had failed in Project Will, and Will was bound and determined to capture him, then he was going to eat Will.
Because it's just, it's very...
That's how I read it.
It's very jarring, especially in light of what will happen at the very, very end. Because that, yeah. like, what happens at the very, very end of season of, not sorry, of the season, very, very end of the,
I think what happens at that point,
yeah.
Hannibal is, for once, having his back against the wall, right?
Okay.
For once, Hannibal is...
Desperate?
Is desperate. I think that's where it is.
So, yeah. So, Hannibal is about to eat his brains, but then Verger's goons, and Verger has almost sort of got Hannibal with this other Italian police officer who has sort of helped flesh out some of Hannibal's background and his murders he had committed as a young man. But then Hannibal does all sorts of terrible tortures to that guy. Verger finally captures Hannibal and is planning on both eating him and, this was pretty awesome, bringing in the killer from season one of True Detective to be his, like, murder chef.
Oh, wow.
So that same actor, I thought,
that's
like...
pretty good, yeah.
This creepy, like, butler chef, murder chef, was... And it's the awesome villain from True Detective. So it was this... because these two shows, I think, are getting a lot of parallels. Yeah. As these kind of...
Although apparently everyone hates the second season of True Detective.
Most people I've heard have not been happy. It's not as quotable as season one.
Right.
But these kind of... These sort of horror police shows that have a touch of the weird and a touch of the supernatural about it. Because for all that season three... was strange and non-linear, in many ways it was not as mystical.
Hmm.
Like, you didn't have the kind of, like, Will Grammo vision.
Yeah.
In the same way, where, like, I don't That's know, true. Like you know, you didn't have, like, birds bursting forth out of, like, horse hearts and things like that.
You kind of got that more in the second season.
There was, well, or
the second half of the third season.
Well, you got something... You got a sort of metaphysical element, but it seemed to be a lot more psychological, or at least it can be explained in a more psychological way. You did get the bizarre Dollar Hideo vision. The Italian half ends with you know, Verger having him having Will Graham and Hannibal captured. He's going to eat both of them, or he's going to steal. He's going to carve off Will Graham's face and have that on his face, and then Alana Bloom and Margot free Hannibal. They do really gross things with pigs.
Yes.
And fluids. And they murder Mason Verger with an eel. Which the eel has been a major part of visually, you know, sort of establishing the kind of the Verger.
But I feel like that's canon as well, that he gets killed by his eel.
Oh, really?
I think it is.
See, because it's funny because I thought Verger lasted longer. I thought the Verger stuff came... after, like, a manhunt, after Red Dragon and stuff like that.
I don't remember where it comes in the canon. I'm just thinking about, like,
what
I
actually happens. Okay,
well, in terms
there we go.
Of.
So that's that. I'm proud that it managed to work that in. So yeah. So they take out Verger, and Hannibal is sort of on the loose with Will, but then turns himself in. Will is, like, messed up, you know, from having almost been, like, having his face taken off after almost having his brain eaten. Again, there's. This show makes you have to, you know, discuss things in a really disturbing way. And then we get the 3-year jump. And we enter practically a completely different show. Like, I mean, there's definitely... The Bedelia stuff is a big through line from the first half of the season. But other than that, and generally just...
Because she manages to preserve her own career by saying that she was... like, drugged by Hannibal and brought along on this European adventure against her will.
Yeah, like, she began sort of dosing herself with like, heroin or something to make it seem like she was doing all this, not in her, not Copus Mentis. Copus Mentis? Anyway. And then we enter into Red Dragon, and this...
Compos Mentis.
Thank you. This was fascinating. This was really well done. And I have not... Now, there have been two movies that deal with the Red Dragon book, as far as I'm aware. There was the Manhunter movie with Brian Cox.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly Vince Vaughn, or not Vince Vaughn. Someone. Oh. And then there was the Edward Norton, Anthony right. Hopkins, Ralph Fiennes.
Yes.
I think Ralph Fiennes was the Red Dragon
yes.
in the 90s movie. I did not see either of them.
we're really interesting people to be doing a podcast on Hannibal because we know none of the source material.
I saw Silence of the Lambs. I have a VHS copy of that floating around somewhere. I enjoyed it. Not well enough to, you know, to do further research on it. But yeah, but this second half of the season felt like a more traditional sort of it felt like more traditional Hannibal, right? Like
yeah.
It was a mystery, sort of, a serial killer that they were sort of tracking down and trying to like and Will get trying to get into the mind of,
yeah,
and then going to Hannibal for assistance. But it was fascinating because you're getting all the Will Graham Hannibal stuff, but it spent so much time with Dollar-Eyed, so much time with the killer himself.
Yeah.
And that was really well done.
Well, it was also Thorin.
Yes, the fact that it's Richard Armitage, who Rachel and I are not super inclined to be fans of.
No, I love him because he married the Vicar of Dibley.
Oh, spoiler for Vicar of Dibley.
I love him for that reason.
Rachel, when we were in the hotel in Rhode Island for Necronomicon. That's right. We're not even talking about like the actual super geeky stuff we did where we were yeah. at a horror convention.
We were flipping channels and I was like, oh, this is like, we were trying to figure out what this movie was that we were watching. And it's sort of like, it kind of had this Lord of the Rings feel to it, like big battle scenes, but it was like really crappy special effects. It like almost looked like a video game. And we were, I genuinely thought that it was like epic movie or something
some parody movie
of Lord of the Rings, and then we realized it was The Hobbit.
It was the actual Battle of the Five Armies,
and it was just like, oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Yeah, seriously.
Sorry, I had to go retrieve a tissue from our dog's mouth.
Like we do.
We're a very professional operation here at Geekly Yoked.
But yeah, so Richard Armitage with doing some interesting, at times almost doing a Batman Dark Knight voice.
A little bit.
But telling this really compelling story just about this one guy. And thinking back on it, I'm like, okay, you know, they're playing up that like, oh, this is this great new serial killer who's doing like all this terrible stuff. And I'm looking at his body count and I'm trying not to be cynical, but I'm like, there are guys in season one that like were racking yeah. up a much bigger, much faster body count than this yeah. guy. But they really played up this sense of threat and this sense of his inner life and this becoming. You know, that's yeah. that we went from design to becoming. The fact that he was his own creation.
Yeah.
And it's a little similar to the Meccano Beast guy in season
two,
right?
Well, I think it's interesting. So the shift from design to becoming, I think, is interesting because there was a definite idea that Dollar-Eyed was not in control of himself.
Yeah.
He was being made into something other.
And fighting against
this other. Whereas the serial killers earlier on in season one had their design. They weren't conflicted in the way that which was what made Francis Dollar-Eyed such a compelling person to watch for the last six or eight episodes.
Yeah.
Because he was like struggling, he was becoming, and he wanted to become, but there was a part of him that didn't, and like, who was the dragon and who was him? And that was really
well, and
that was really cool. And
the relationship that they introduced was both compelling because like, oh, here's this like threat, because this woman is in threat because Dollar-Hyde is kind of like focused on her, and we learn that she's kind of this parallel for this, you know, figure, because his whole thing is based on this.
Sorry, elaborate what you're saying.
So Dollar-Hyde has this female companion, this blind woman who works on his film footage, because he takes night vision footage of the families he's going to murder and watches it, and it revs him up, or you know, deals with the dragon or what have you. But he develops a relationship with her, like a sort of romantic relationship,
yeah.
and she appreciates him because he shows no pity towards her,
mm-hmm.
and he is drawn towards her And you're at first like, oh, is it just drawn towards her because there's this person who can't see him and he's got this weird issue with his face and with his, like,
who he is. Who has a cleft palate.
But also, she is this like, archetypal figure in his bizarre...
Yeah.
Because his whole thing is based on a woodcut of Blake's, of the Great Red Dragon, you know, this giant beast who has this woman encoiled in its tails. And she is that woman, but she's also not, right?
Well, like, she has agency.
Well, and the show does such an amazing job...
I thought she was a great character.
...of portraying that. And again, and I'm so happy with for Brian Fuller because, you know, he has made it explicit that he is completely against, you know, depictions of sexual assault. Yeah. And this could have gone there
I feel
so
like
many times.
Any other show... And, like... At least any other show would have made the threat of her, of the sexual assault, much more pressing.
But it wasn't.
And it wasn't that. It wasn't
And they had a sexual relationship, and it's disturbing because you know who this guy is and what he's done, but that's not the violence, right?
Yeah.
And she is very much, she is the aggressor. She is the sort of the active participant in that. The one who sort of starts that off. And so that relationship is really well done.
And really pursues him.
And then...
Also a woman of color.
Yes, that's very... Yes, indeed. And this is, again, it's a straightforward story. You know, they have to bring back Will Graham out of semi-retirement. Yeah. And he has his family, which, you know, was a canonical thing. Yeah. I still prefer my version where he has had a family this entire time and they're just slightly off camera watching all this stuff going on. But yes, they tack on a family with adopted older son, so that can be part of things because they get threatened. Dollar Hyde, once Will is on his scent, Hannibal puts the scent of this family on Dollar Hyde, and he goes and threatens. And you see Will Graham's wife deal with it in a really powerful, great scene, right?
Oh, it was amazing. I couldn't quite watch it, but it was awesome.
Yeah, like where she, you know, senses something is wrong and just goes into kind of, you know, action mode to hide her and her son and protect them from this killer. And it's just, it's this, there's so many great just like horror movie moments in this season, you know, taken from, you know, all elements of horror that I don't know, it's showing a distillation of the genre in a beautiful way. It's also fitting that Bilbo make a whole bunch of noise because dogs are threatened in terrible ways, but not injured, so you can enjoy the show.
It's true. Where are we going from this?
I guess the real thing to look at is now the ending, because you've had this killer, you know,
mentioned like the mystical or the...
Oh, yes.
Like, they did this really cool thing the whole season, or this half of the season, where people visit Hannibal in his prison cell, because Hannibal's in prison now.
Yes.
But it's in the European setting.
Yeah, well, it's the whole, the mind palace is now fully in play, right? Whereas before with Will Graham, you'd sort of see Will Graham, like, you know, in his fishing stream by himself.
Yeah.
Hannibal... in these scenes has drawn people into his world. So he's, you know, he's in the churches talking.
So even though he is imprisoned, he is still, it's that sense that he is still in control.
Oh, yes.
This is still his world. You never see Hannibal defeated.
No. And there are moments, right? I mean, I think the getting the comeuppance fight with Jack, And that comes very close to when he tries to eat Will's brain.
Yeah, and I would argue that that's a point where his back's against the
wall. When he's captured by Verger. Like, although even when he's captured by Verger...
He orchestrates his own escape.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Yeah, so it's definitely like the moment between Jack Crawford wailing on him and getting captured by Verger that we kind of see him at his nadir, as it were. And the relationship continues to progress, right? I mean, that's the through line of all this, is that relationship between Hannibal and Will with Jack Crawford and Alana Bloom. I mean, I give credit to the show. Like, they maintain...
Yeah. But even though Will has gotten out, Will has another family, Will has made another life, that he cannot escape that thrall.
Yeah. And he's brought back in. And it threatens his family and directly, because, you know, Hannibal... is the one who sets Dollar Hyde on his family, and he tells Will as much. And then that begins to take us towards the end, You know, towards the episode we just watched, which again I'm still sort of reeling from because I didn't read the summary, so I was trying, like, I completely bought the fake out at the beginning of the episode.
Oh yeah,
yeah, because Dolaride brings his blind girlfriend in, sort of, you know, reveals who he is, that he's the dragon, and then like threatens to set her on fire, and then like takes a shotgun and seems to shoot himself in the head, and she tells the police as such, and they're sort of, I guess the Tooth Fairy is dead, but no, it was some other guy. And I was like, oh wow, are they, like, is there, I mean, I could believe that this show would kill off their main villain,
yeah,
and then the rest of the episode would just be like coming to terms with that. Like, I could believe the show would do that, but that's not the case, and I'm assuming that's a fake out from the book, yeah, as well, because yeah, so he faked his death, gets to Will Graham, and essentially Will Graham and he and Hannibal and Jack Crawford like arrange this bizarre, like, multifaceted fake escape attempt so that Hannibal can escape to draw Dolarhyde towards him, but Dolarhyde is actually arranging it because he wants to kill Hannibal.
Yeah.
And we get the final scene, which is amazing. And I'd seen people on Facebook
it was yeah.
Well, it was.
The music was perfect.
Yeah. They, you know, Hannibal and Will are having their wine, and it's, you know, it's the fact that Dolaride chooses families, right? And I turn to Rachel and I'm like, they're the perfect family, because that's his whole thing, as he goes and he doesn't kill people, he changes them, and he picks the perfect families. And I'm like, all along they've been crafting this perfect family, and here they are in that moment, and that's when he shoots Hannibal. Like, you know, the glass explodes. You see sort of blood beginning to blossom on Hannibal's clothes, his immaculate clothes. And Dolarhyde erupts from that carnage to sort of gloat over Hannibal before stabbing Will Graham in the cheek. And then he and Will Graham get into a weird fight where they keep pulling the knife out of themselves and stabbing into the other. And then Hannibal, like, leaps on him. And you get this, like, this amazing wolves on a stag kind of fight. Yeah.
It was amazingly choreographed. And to see finally Will and Hannibal coming together in that moment, I don't want to go too much into it, but it was the consummation of their relationship. There was something sexual to it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if in the sense that their relationship for the last three seasons has been this
build up
toying with one another and figure like back and forth and will they won't they, right?
Yeah.
And this was the consummation of that, which is bizarre, but that was certainly what I felt like it was evoking.
And they kill him. Like, they you know, together they come and they defeat this dragon, and you see, like,
the whole thing is that Francis Dolarhyde has had these, like, he sees his wings, yeah, right? He sees himself becoming the dragon, and
they bring the dragon down. And at one point I'm like, oh, they can start seeing their hit points, you know, as they're fighting the boss fight. But yeah, they bring him down and he's dead, and they're there, like, covered in his blood and their blood in the moonlight. And they embrace, and then Will leaps themselves, like, throws them both over the cliff into the waters below. And I was sitting there trying to think, okay, at this point, do they know they're canceled or not? Like, you know, yeah, or, you know, is are they essentially going to, like, we'll leave it open, but if we need to,
now, here's a question for you. When I was reading, after we finished watching the episode, I just looked at what it said in Wikipedia, Wikipedia summary for the episode,
oh.
And it claimed Hannibal was the one that threw them over the ledge.
Really?
And I thought it was Will.
I'm
like 90% sure it was Will that pushed, because the focus was on Will, and he clearly pushed them over. But the Wikipedia summary said, whoever wrote the Wikipedia summary thought it was Hannibal.
See, and again, I feel like it makes more sense for it to be Will.
Because, well, it's the last thing Will can do.
Well, like, yeah, because at this point, is Will now transformed by Hannibal? Like,
because I don't see Hannibal having that self-destructive streak.
No.
Right? I don't think that's something Hannibal would do. I think Will would, right?
Yeah.
If Will sees that as the only...
Yes.
As the only thing he can do.
Precisely. And... yeah, I would be interested to argue with someone who,
yes,
to see what their take on it would be, or to go back and review the footage.
Yes.
But no, I feel like that is Will, you know, in that moment, in that summation, in, yeah, that, you know, climax, you know, pushing themselves into the void, whether they died or not. You know, four seasons in a cookbook. We'll find out. But that's not the end.
I know. What do you think of the last scene?
I don't know. I mean, I appreciate Scully in, you know, attractive attire, you know, on a, at a, at a dinner with a giant roast her leg.
Yeah. But there were other places set at the table.
There were other places.
Were Will and Hannibal there?
Mmm. That's true. Was that, was she there at the thing? I don't know. I feel like, I sort of feel like that was her own private ritual. Because you sort of see, you see Alana and Margot head off with their son now that Hannibal is free. Like, you see them kind of escape into the night. One of my friends was really worried Hannibal was going to eat their baby.
Was that Carlos?
Possibly. And you don't see Jack. You don't get really any sort of closure with Jack. But you do get this final shot on Bedelia, you know, eating her own leg, or at least her leg is prepared. And that's it. That's, you know, that is the end of the series. That is our final image we take away. I almost appreciate it as like a Fuller-esque joke.
Yeah. But man, that last, I have to say, that last scene of Will and Hannibal fighting the dragon was phenomenal.
Well, this show, for all that it's been like lots of people sitting and talking quietly and saying,
when it does action, it does action.
Saying, tell me, Will, question. When it does...
We should talk about the Hannibal dialogue.
Oh, yeah, how to talk like Hannibal. look at the subject, something surrounding what you're doing.
Something mundane surrounding.
Mundane subject. Make some profound statement about that. Say, tell me, Will, question about said subject. which is a lot of fun. But yeah, that moment.
Sorry, I'm still thinking about Tell Me Will. although Hannibal the Zoo is also wonderful.
Hannibal the Zoo.
Hannibal text, the Zoo on Twitter.
Text from Hannibal.
Text from Hannibal.
All of that is, it's, well, and now there's apparently just like a supercut of Hannibal in all of his suits.
Oh, really? Like, okay.
Yeah. But no, this moment, you know, it is this perfect summation, you know, and you know, in theory, if things got picked up, or you know, something, someone, you know, wisens up down the line, like a show, you know, this is a show about battling wizards, serial killers, so they can come back just fine. But it is this beautiful moment.
If Frederick Chilton is not dead yet,
yeah, that's right. They set fire to him.
They chopped off his lips, set him on fire, and like, he definitely is killed in the canonical books. He is killed that way.
Well, let's also remember that prior to this, he's had his like chunks of his organs taken out by Eddie Izzard. He was shot in the head by my girl, and now he's had his lips bitten off. Let us be clear, and set on fire, and he's still alive, alive and laughing. And we know that he goes on to be the homeopathic salesman.
He does
Pushing
go on
Daisies.
To be the homeopathic salesman.
I'm just going
to
assume Pushing Daisy takes place after this.
Okay.
I think that just the death of Hannibal ushers in the Pushing Daisies averse.
Okay.
I think that'll be my headcanon. But
what does that say about Wonderfalls? Since we know that Pushing Daisies and Wonderfalls take place in the same universe, what does that say for Alana Bloom?
Well, I think Wonderfalls is the prequel to this, right?
Oh,
like, Alana Bloom after Wonderfalls,
okay.
She takes her like things talking to her,
okay.
And becomes a psychiatrist.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
Inspired by the Brass Monkey psychiatrist of hers.
Yes, of course.
So that's how we work in the Monsters of Mockingbird Lane. the Brian Fuller thing I have not seen.
Yes.
I can't speak to, but. As a priest, what is your takeaway from Hannibal now that it's over?
I referenced Hannibal in our Bible study this morning.
Go on.
Well, they were talking about sins and sin, like sins being an absence of the virtue, right? Like, it's
not enough to
just say, I'm not going to sin. You have to
actively. Yes.
And I may have brought up Hannibal and this idea that Hannibal is a perversion of things that are good, right? Especially in the first season of Hannibal, right? Like food and drink and community, and Hannibal perverts all of that, and you see a grotesque form of it, but it's not that Hannibal has any inherent, like the evil of Hannibal is nothing that has its own existence. It is his perversion and twisting of things that are good. The whole way the serial killers are framed is a twisting and perversion of beauty, a twisting and perversion of art.
So I guess...
And so, I mean, like, and I've said this, I mean, I feel like, as a priest, I have said this so many times in discussing Hannibal, but I, despite its, you know, despite its darker themes and despite all of the blood and gore, I can watch something like Hannibal so much more easily than I can watch so much that's on television right now. Because whatever issues Hannibal has, it is not nihilistic.
Well, that was going to be my question, right? Like, is this a world without grace?
I don't think it is. I mean, there's a lot of, like, there's a world without a lot of
smiling.
It's a world without a lot of smiling, but there are people that are still, like, and all of the characters are, like, Jack Crawford, right? I mean, he is one of our quote-unquote good guys, but he's a complicated character. He uses people. He uses people just like Hannibal uses people.
Yeah.
Right? Will is arguably just a pawn in the game between Hannibal and Jack, especially at the very beginning. And Jack doesn't really think about what the impact he's having on people, right? And so there is a lot of gray and there is a lot of ambiguity. At the same time, it is a world with beauty and it is, I don't know. I feel like there is grace in the world. It's just not unrelenting. I mean, even the fact that Will and Hannibal are able to have a friendship, right? The fact that, I mean, in the last scene with Will and Hannibal, when they're having their glass of wine,
yes.
And Hannibal says, you know, my compassion for you is inconvenient, Will, and Will answers, well, if you have a taste for beef, it is inconvenient to have compassion upon a cow. And in a way, Hannibal's love for Will is a tiny seed of grace in his life.
Interesting.
Right? It is that tiny edge of humanity, just like Dolarhyde's love for girl whose name I can't remember.
Reba?
Is a tiny glimmer of salvation in him. There is what we see in this world is actual connection, right? Or people who are at least craving that. I mean, it feels weird to put that in the hands of these serial killers, but again, I think what we've been talking about is that these people are who are depicted as these serial killers in this series are fascinating because they are reaching out for something. They are reaching out for some kind of connection. They want to be understood. They want someone to see their design. And it's a perversion of real connection. It's a perversion of real communication. At the same time, the virtue or the value that's being longed for is still that positive good. So it's a world. What makes me not see the world of Hannibal as a dark, nihilistic place is that there still are these people that are craving this connection. And it's a world that puts that human connection and human love and friendship, it holds that up as a thing that we need and a thing to be desired and a thing that is good. And even though it's perverted and even though it's twisted, it can only be perverted and twisted because the world values those things in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that does make sense. And everything is elevated, right? Like, it's not just that, like, they're existing in a kind of mundane world where, of course, like, you know, prostitutes get killed and...
Right.
And, you know, oh, there's just going to be murders and it's every other week. It's the same sort of thing, right? Like in a way, you could look at these sort of procedural cop shows as existing just in this kind of purgatory of nothingness. The show does draw you towards beauty and make something as sort of gross as a snail have beauty.
Yeah.
And I think that's well, and we've talked before. I mean, that's Fuller's strength, right? Is playing with these themes of death and food.
Yeah.
And making them both beautiful.
Truth.
And I think that's going to be it. I think that's going to cover our Hannibal.
I wanted to come back. I wanted to come back and I don't because I feel like it ended really well.
No, I mean, it ended on as amazing a note as it could. And I mean, I think we want more just because it's so good and because
But I feel like, I think there's good cliffhangers and there's bad cliffhangers, right?
This one literally was on a cliff.
Yes, it was literally on a cliff. The first season of Gallivant was a stupid cliffhanger that didn't need to exist, and it didn't do anything, and it just set people up to be in uncertain situations for the sake of setting them up to be in uncertain situations.
They did get their second season, though.
They did, thankfully. But this was a good kind of ending that says, okay, we don't know exactly what the resolution was, but given what's been built up to this point, there was a culmination.
Yes.
And it was an open-ended culmination, but it was at least, like, a thematically appropriate culmination to what... Like, we had that strange consummation of all of the toying around with Will and Hannibal that we've seen for three seasons.
Oh, and we should just do... I think Rachel Colwell will murder us if we don't mention it, but the Abigail Hobbs fake-out.
Possibly the
meanest thing the show did. Yeah, speaking true. Of, like, the cliffhangers where you don't know who is still alive.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I think they definitely ended it on a beautiful note, right? Like, they gave us something beautiful. And I don't quite know how often I will be able to return to this world.
I kind of have a strange compulsion to rewatch the series.
This was really well done. And I'm very interested in seeing kind of what happens next, because I think Fuller's working on American Gods. Is that his next big project? And there's talks of Mads Mikkelsen possibly being in the Benedict Cumberbatch Doctor Strange Marvel movie. And Will Graham, I'm sure Hugh Dancy will do things. I'm fine forever just knowing him from this. I still don't know what he did aside from this.
Mary Claire Danes.
good on you. okay, so I think that's going to do it for us. I think from the world of faith, family and fandom in no particular order. Geek out, y'all.
Woo!
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
I would break into your house.
I would break through your windows.
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
I'd wreck all the furniture in your house
that you fruitlessly piled up against the door.
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
you could run but you wouldn't get far.
A nice and tasty two-legged meal.
If I were an undead crawler, I'd bite your leg.
If I were an undead crawler, I'd hide in the dark waiting in your yard. If I were an undead crawler,
I'd make you scream, wouldn't be that hard.
If I were an undead crawler, maybe I could make some gurgling noises.
That's very attractive.
I am super hot undead crawler. Good thing this
is. Did you just snort?
Maybe. Don't they snort?
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
we would make a nasty mess.
Make a nasty mess of your face!
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
I would not on all of your pets,
especially the cat, because it deserves it.
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were an undead crawler,
I would savor your remains,
maybe suck on an intestine.
If I were an undead crawler, I'd chew your
what we'd have in store. If I were an undead crawler,
there'd be lots of blood and guts and gore.
If I were an undead crawler.
You know, I don't actually like the whole blood thing.
What?
No, it's just kind
of... Why are you only telling me this now? We're in the middle of a song.
I don't really like body fluids. I don't know why you guys are all into that.
So if you're sleeping and you drool, do you wake up and freak out?
Well, you know, I've seen you drool and that's gross.
If I were an undead crawler,
if I were, I don't want to be an undead crawler,
I would feast on the flesh of the living,
I don't even like my steak rare.
If I were an undead crawler,
but I don't want to be an undead crawler,
I would tear out your tongue.
You know, I had tongue once, it was gross.
Would you just...
It was spongy too.
Would you rather be the victim?
Maybe I'd survive the apocalypse.
They would target you because you are chunky.
What? No, I don't think I am chunky.
When I am an undead crawler,
you'd
I'll
rip
your
flesh. You know, that just makes me all uncomfortable.
Stop it!
If I were an undead crawler, fine, I'd be an undead crawler.
If I were an undead crawler, you'd still be the first one to die.
If I were an undead crawler,
ah! I'd eat brains.